Some of our landings were desperate adventures. We are now prepared to meet the inevitable counterattacks with power and with confidence.
My name is Gary Butterfield.
My name is Cole Ross.
And it's a roundtable favorite.
Yeah. This is one of our special area wrap-up episodes where we do some interview stuff and then read your responses to Liurnia, specifically this time. Liurnia, yeah. And the environments contained therein.
Them lakes.
Them lakes.
Yeah. We have, just as a reminder, because these are only, you know, there's going to be like 8 of these in the season or so. These are where listener responses get read. It's also where we bring in some guest energy. Mm-hmm. So we have an interview that we recorded, and then we also had an email interview that we did that we're going to read. The interview we recorded is we had the privilege to talk to Open Mike Eagle about Elden Ring.
It was a pleasure, and it feels like it was a million years ago.
It was a while ago because we wanted to work around his schedule. What a smart dude. Yep. And also, like, I really hope that I because I'm me and I get self-conscious and feel like a ding dong and stuff. I was like, man, did we ask good enough questions over Mike Eagle? Like, were we smart enough for this dude? And there was like a little bit of that feeling, but incredibly nice guy and really fun talk and just like super cool.
Yeah.
Super smart dude. Really, really happy with how that turned out. Mm-hmm. I'm excited for people to be able to hear it.
Yeah. They can tell, you know, they can determine for themselves if we ask smart enough questions.
And they will.
Yep.
just gun shy about being yelled at. So shall we go into it?
I think we shall.
Yeah. Here goes. And now we are joined, very happy to welcome Open Mike Eagle to the podcast.
Hello. Mike. Hey.
Thank you so much for being here.
I'm very excited. This is an exciting moment for me.
That's exciting for us. It's real cool that you made the time.
Yeah, very awesome.
It's real cool. It's real cool that you smart people know that I exist. That's cool for me.
Vice versa. Listeners, you might know Open Mike Eagle from many of his records. My favorite one being Anime Trauma Divorce. And then you also may know his podcast, the Stony Island Audio Podcast Network. What had happened was Dad Bod Rap Pod. What am I missing, Mike?
Secret Scan is my one-off interview show. And like you said, it is a network, so we got a bunch of other shows from other hosts. We have a hip-hop trivia show called The Questions. We have The Raw Report with Dice Raw. We have a podcast about fatherhood and hip-hop that's called The Fatherhoods. And there's plenty more.
Yeah, very cool. Very recommended. And we found out that Mike is a big Souls guy. So yeah, and he's very gracious and agreed to come on the show. Yeah. Can you briefly kind of talk about your history with these games and this loosely defined series here?
So I got into it in what I feel like is a weird way. I mean, I've listened to a lot of Jeremy's Don't Give Up Skeleton pod, so I've heard a bunch of other ways that people got into the series. But mine was that... in my adulthood, I was very off cycle when it came to having consoles. So I typically always had whatever Nintendo was selling as a console. And then even then, it was usually a generation behind. So I got into this point where I had been playing all of my video games on the Wii. And I think I had finished both Zelda games. And this is years after those had come out. And I felt like I was just out of games on the Wii to play that were engaging to me and my adulthood. So I decided to buy a PS3 at that point. And we were in the middle of the PS4 cycle at that time. So PS3 consoles were cheap, and it was very easy to find comprehensive lists of what people thought the best PS3 games were. So I would see Dark Souls on a lot of those lists. And I would pretty much buy all the games on those lists because at that time they were all pretty cheap. You can get most of them for $10 or $15. So I was playing stuff like BioShock and Portal and all those sorts of games and having a good time. And at one point I bought Dark Souls and played it for like 15 minutes. And I was like, I don't know what this is. And I do not like it at all. But I ended up going back to it, I think after maybe reading some more or seeing it on some more lists. And when I got back into it, I hit that point where you're playing in, I believe it's the Undead Burg. And I don't know, the gameplay loop started to make sense to me. And like I felt my attention turning to the inputs that I was putting in on the controller and realizing how much more important they were in this game than any other game that I'd ever played. And once that kind of clicked for me, not only did I fall in love with that game, it just changed how I looked at gaming forever. Like I realized from that point how much games had been handholding me, you know, including those Zelda games on the Wii and the BioShock games. And it's just, there was just so much not trusting me to figure things out from developers. Yeah. And therefore me not actually being very engaged. And once I realized that a game like that exists that demanded that level of attention from me, it kind of changed my relationship to gaming in general. And from that point forward, I was a Souls fan.
We talk about something real similar to that. Like first, the experience of bouncing off initially, or just having that feeling untethered initially, is really common. Everybody does that.
It needs to incubate. That is such a common story. I mean, even Manny the last interview we did, Manny Perez, had a similar story. My story was really similar. So it's fun to hear you say it was like that for you.
Yeah. And I think you're right on in terms of it asking you, you know, when you talk about it's asking you to think about your button presses.
Yeah.
When a lot of video games are kind of, the goal is to put you in a place where you're not really thinking about it.
Right.
I feel like you can't autopilot it. So it requires you bring more of yourself.
And really that was a huge experience for me. I just feel like, I guess media in general stopped asking a lot of consumers at a certain point. And I feel like maybe just being like a kid of the 90s, I felt like stuff was weirder and more challenging, and you know, and that could be looking at the past rose colored glasses for sure, but it definitely felt like something that it was refreshing to have something ask more of me than to be pressing buttons randomly until I accomplished the goal.
Yeah.
Is there any older media that you're into as a 90s kid that you think you could draw a line between, you know, that kind of was evoked by this new experience?
I could, but only really for myself. Like, I think about something like the Gary Shandling Show, right? And that's not a direct line.
That's exactly like Dark Souls. like just a boss title card, Gary the Shandling pops up. Just immediately comes up and bodies you like you're Ricky Gervais.
I want that experience so bad now. My goodness. But, you know, just how a show like that didn't think the viewer was stupid. Mm-hmm. And it would constantly kind of point at what it was and point at, you know, the conventions of the sitcom and be subversive towards those things. I feel like this is what Dark Souls invoked in me, that sort of activation, like, oh, wait, yes, I have done this before in other ways, and that is not the only way to do this thing. And mm-hmm. I was thankful for another option.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did this carry forward with, you know, we're in our Elden Ring season, mm-hmm. a Bonfireside Chat. How did Elden Ring kind of fit in that context for you? Like, do you consider it to be a huge departure? Do you feel like it's coming back? What is most interesting to you about Elden Ring when you think about all of the, you know, being a Souls fan and all of these games kind of together as a whole?
So I feel like, to answer that adequately, I need to talk through my Souls experiences a little bit more.
Please do.
Oh, please. Yeah.
So, okay, Dark Souls 1, I've probably played through maybe 5 or 6 times now. Something I always go back to. Just, you know, it's I wouldn't quite call it the pinnacle, because actually Dark Souls 3 is my favorite of the series. Mm-hmm. And I know that's a very unpopular opinion.
I mean, it would be unpopular on this show between us, but I don't know. Yeah. I think that there are plenty of people who are in line with you, and, you know, obviously, yeah, I want to hear you talk about it.
I certainly understand, because I remember hearing you two talk about it, and I know from a story perspective, it's a huge letdown, and I absolutely get that part, like, yeah, that it's completely fan servicey and doesn't do much to kind of close the loops that it had opened in Dark Souls 1 in a satisfying way. But for me, these games, like, the way that my mind categorizes them, like, each one of them is a sentence. Like, Dark Souls 1 is a sentence to me. Like, the order in which things are done, the sequence, is what I enjoy about coming, yeah, back to the game. So, I thought Dark Souls 1 was a great sentence. I thought Dark Souls 3 was a more refined sequence.
Mm.
That I enjoy the completion loop of that game more than I enjoy the completion loop of Dark Souls 1.
Yeah.
And so I come back to Dark Souls 3 so much more. Dark Souls 2, I played through once and didn't really enjoy it at all. And Bloodborne, I enjoyed, but I never felt like I wanted to repeat it. To me, when it got to Dark Souls 3, it was refining all the elements down to an experience that was the most enjoyable for me.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Did you ever get around to playing Demon's Souls?
I did when the PS5 remake came out, and I started. I was very excited to try it, and I started it, and I didn't like it. And when I think about why, I think to me it's I found the boss fights that I actually got to and engaged with, I found them very unenjoyable. I felt like they were a little too gimmicky, mm-hmm, and that just it wasn't what I was in those games for. And again, to go back to Dark Souls 3, one of my favorite things about that game is the boss fights.
Yeah.
Especially, like, that's a huge gulf, right? Like, if you kind of find your sweet spot in Dark Souls 3, just in, mm-hmm, terms of how it feels to move around, you know, in your character and kind of the encounter design being like, it's a little bit, it refined is a great word for it, because I very much love Demon's Souls, and one of the things, because when I came to it, that experimentation and stuff was, I was able to see kind of past you know, my hands, I guess,
yeah,
if that makes sense. Like, if I had, I feel I can relate to what you're talking about. Like, if I had found my spot later, yeah, I think I might feel the same. I just came to Demon's Souls earlier than that. Yeah. I think that order of play ends up mattering a lot for how people land on these things sometimes.
Particularly if you're into the bosses in Demon's Souls are really simple. Oftentimes, right, they can kind of be summarized by their gimmick or by their, you know, kind of like one sentence description. Not a lot of complexity in the movesets, or, you know, certainly no phase changes, things like that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Who, what's your favorite boss in Dark Souls 3?
The, Lothric and Lorien.
Yeah.
That's a good fight.
Yeah.
I love that fight so much. It is so engaging to me and rhythmic and,
It's also like, I, you know, you heard us on the show, like, the story for Dark Souls 3 doesn't do it for me in a general sense,
right,
but I love the drama of that fight.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the line deliveries in it, like, give me chills. Like, it's,
dear, you know, really brother,
it's so good. It's that is our curse, rise, if you will.
Yeah.
It's so good.
No, Lothric and his brother end up really being a nice balance of story and play, really bouncing off of each other, resonating really well.
Yeah,
I thought it was a really interesting twist on the gank fight too, with those two, because they're two, but just one riding on the other's back just gave it a different dynamic than most 2-on-1 fights in the Souls, yeah, series.
Yeah.
It opened up the door for the Elden Ring fight where it's three kids in a trench coat. and you fight all of them at once. So, it's like, if you can have one guy on one back, why stop? Just Jenga it up. And
I love it. You know, I've often had daydream fantasies of a Dark Souls game set in like the ghetto, because that's where I live.
Yeah.
And that boss fight would fit in the world. It would fit. It would fit great. That's something. I like thinking about that.
Oh man.
The stat, you know, title card stack of dudes.
Yeah. The little homies. I love it. Yeah. I love it.
The furtive homies.
Oh, it's great.
Where did you, what did you end up thinking of Elden Ring? Like, did you you know, so we got a kind of our context leading up to that.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I enjoy Elden Ring a lot. And it was a different sort of enjoyment, because like I said, to me, the engaging thing, or the comforting thing almost, about having a Souls game is you get really used to a sequence. And Elden Ring, taking the From Software basics and putting them in this open world, it really broke that idea. It broke the idea of having a sequence. And where I thought I might be very turned off by that, I actually really enjoyed it a lot. I enjoyed not knowing what to do next. I enjoyed the exploration, like true exploration. Like, I can go in any direction and there will be something that I have not encountered. I did enjoy that a lot. And I was very nervous. I was very nervous about this game because I don't like open world games at all.
Give me that question.
Yeah. I have this sense from the ones that I've played. Like, I don't like Breath of the Wild at all. I don't like Skyrim at all. I don't like cooking in games. Like, I don't like my weapons breaking. Like, all, like, and I don't like being encouraged to do stuff in a game that won't matter. I don't like that the game doesn't care about wasting my time if my goal is to try to like get stronger in ways that are important or accomplish, you know, actual goals in a game. So I was worried, but I feel like Elden Ring approached the open world in a sense that, in a way that was still satisfying for me, because it didn't have a lot of time wasting activities in it. Like when I learned that there was crafting, I was concerned, but yeah, that it's, you know, that it's one button push that I can deal with. I'm not like setting up a bonfire in the middle of the field to try to make fish, you know.
Was there a particular moment where you kind of felt that relief when you realized, oh, okay, I'm still in good hands?
I think that maybe the first time I crafted something and realized that it was just literally assembling ingredients and pressing button like that, that was actually that was quite comforting for me. It eased my anxiety. You know what was weird? And it took me a second to realize this, but like 2 days into playing Elden Ring, I'm like, something is weird about this game. What is it? And what it was that all of the forest animals don't immediately attack you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is so different from a soft game. That there's living, breathing entities in the world that do not immediately thirst for your blood.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There's an element of it being neutral to you. It's like pushing that neutrality towards you. Because I've always felt like that was a FromSoft thing. You know, like enemies are hostile towards you, but I always love the moment when they kill you and they just walk away. You know, slowly. They chose the camera and they're just like, all right, I gotta get back to work.
Back to the coffee. Yeah.
you know, like there's this indifference that I really love in those games. And I feel like Elden Ring really underlines it by just having some birds that are just hanging out.
Yeah, they're chilling.
If you want their bones, you can have them, but they're not gonna try to get yours. It's none of their business.
Yeah. That was new and different for me.
Yeah, love that. I love it when they subvert it, because the goats are generally on your side, but you can go up to those hills up by the Capitol, and they're the lightning goats that hang out, who hang out in the goat wars, and like will roll at you and shoot lightning at you.
It's just gosh, you gotta love working in a place where you can be paid to come up with stuff like lightning goats. That's crazy. That's so cool.
Every single thing you dream, you just have a whiteboard next to the bed, and you're just like, what about something in an angry sandwich? And you just sketch it out, and then eventually, you know, 3 years down the line, we end up with like the, you know, some kind of something references it. It's great.
Just put up on the whiteboard, you know, like lightning goat question mark. Yeah, and then really somebody good. Comes up, erases the question mark, and puts three exclamation marks out after it.
I love it.
That's super good. So you've played through Elden Ring, you've gotten through it, and everything. How has it aged for you? Like, something that we think a lot about on the network is that, like, you know, you have your kind of impression, with a game, but certain games will stick with you. And a lot of things will slide around in my memory. Like, something, you know, I'll come off of it and I'll have some recency bias and feel really good. And then the more I think about it, something I think I say a lot is like, media that the more you think about it, it gets worse versus media. The more you think about it, it gets better. You know? How has there been any movement with it?
Yeah. I mean, as it's been said, the end game is really something else. But I think, you know, once we understood that they were taking the Dark Souls formula into an open world, then the problem of not being able to funnel characters into the end game at a consistent level, like, I think kind of created the problems in the end game. Like, the bosses are out of control strong. Like, it feels like a crazy difficulty spike, but it almost had to be, because if you did everything in the world, you'd be so over leveled that I could have easily seen where they might have had end game bosses be too easy. So, I mean, I think it was a math problem kind of inherent to this particular approach to development, but it wasn't enjoyable. It was, that part was not enjoyable. You know, the millennia and, the fire giant and, you know, a couple more at the end. It was just like, oh, this is not fun. Cause now I'm like, I'm using spirit summons like a legit crutch, and I'm putting frost on my weapons, and I'm, you know, I wasn't in a situation where I felt like my skill level was getting me through. I felt like I needed lots and lots of help, almost like, okay, were these encounters designed to have lots of help? And I guess that makes sense too, but it's just, that's the problem, right? Open world means a lot of options. And if you have a lot of options, I could see it being difficult to try to come to a point where the end game difficulty is on any sort of logical curve.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the thing I keep seeing come up is, you know, people talk about how in Elden Ring, 40 vitality is the minimum. Like, the right. game wants you to have at least a 40 in your health stat, which has never been true.
Right.
Before. You know, yeah, I have no idea how you would fight. The final bosses of the game are kind of a mixed bag for me. Like, I like some of them, dislike some other ones, but I have no idea what I would do if I hadn't been hammering vitality.
Right.
You know, for that playthrough. You know, they really want that. And on one hand, I think, like, they give you enough experience, like you said, you know, if you do everything, you can get that really easily. But on subsequent playthroughs, you know, you're kind of breaking the promise of an open world if you really are incentivized to do most things to get to that minimum power level.
Yeah, it's they're designing it so you can meander, right, and miss things. And that's kind of always been a FromSoft kind of deal, hiding lots of content, making it optional, painted world, things like that. But by the time you reach the end of that funnel, if you only went down the side, they're like, okay, now go back up to the top and be sure to really go around all sides of it, because we're going to assume that you have gathered all of that experience by doing all that stuff.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. No. The other thing I wanted to speak to real quick about that point, when you said you were like trying Frost, that's the other thing that it kind of bums me out about the final bosses, especially Malenia, is that it does feel like you have to do a different build, almost to make that work.
I had a quality build most of it. And Elden Ring is the first FromSoft game where I found myself using miracles. I had never really used any sort of magic, but I found myself wanting to use some of the stuff I picked up in the world. There's just so many magical treasures you end up fighting really difficult things to get. So I'm like, let me try to use some of this stuff.
Did you find yourself casting like direct damage spells, or were you relying on things like buffs or kind of support spells?
I would say minimally healing spells. Like I always kept a healing spell on deck, but then lightning damage, and I'm trying to remember what. And a lot of I guess in this game, Elden Ring's version of pyromancy, a lot of that was in faith, and that's what I had used in Souls games before. I had used pyromancy, so yeah, I wanted to throw fireball, so I had to put my faith up.
There's only one way to do it. Yes. Only one game in town when it comes to throwing fireballs.
gotta let the frenzy in.
Yeah, talk to a fireball guy. Just kind of keeping on that, when you were going through the game, like what are like some favorites? Like what, the end game, you talked about the end game kind of bummed you out. Like you got like a favorite boss or favorite area. Like where did it really sing for you?
That is the most difficult question for me to answer. I am like midway through a second playthrough right now. And this one, I'm kind of trying to be very deliberate about starting in Limgrave, going like doing everything, going to the Weeping Peninsula, doing everything, going to Liurnia, doing everything. I am around that. I think I just finished the Carrion area and I'm trying to go to Caelid now. And I think the biggest problem, like I said, me, FromSoft Games, think of them as a sequence. There's so much to do here that I can't remember anything.
Yeah.
It's just all so difficult to keep in mind. So I'm playing it and happening upon fights and being like, oh, I enjoyed this. And I'm New Game Plus now, so I can do it with a lot less fear. But I'm not having encounters that are super memorable. I mean, I want to say Radahn, just because that fight is such spectacle.
Yeah.
That it's impossible to forget. But that's not usually the sort of fight that I fall in love with. I usually fall in love with, the Lady Maria, the Artorias, the kind of
like duel.
Yeah, I usually fall in love with the duel. And in this game, I feel like, what is Melania duel? I don't think so.
I mean, for the first part of it,
yeah. Right.
It's a duel, like how Mortal Kombat's a duel, but some of the people get guns. it's a duel, except she has tons of magic powers and like can levitate and stuff.
Yeah,
it's not a fair duel.
They backed off of the like explicitly designed duel, and you have some stuff that is kind of like doing PvP. You get bosses that end up feeling a little bit like that, but not to the level of a Lady Maria.
Right. And that's, I think, I don't know. I can't say I was missing that per se, but if I did have that, I don't remember it, which I think might be problematic.
And it's weird too, because the ones that are duels end up being either having like a gimmick to them. Like I like the different bannermen, like O'Neill, and the other fella, I can't remember his name. Yeah, those are good. And then they summon somebody partway through, which doesn't ruin it, but it kind of makes it not just like a one-on-one Artorias kind of thing. I was gonna ask if you had played it again, so that answers that.
Midway through again.
It's a lot different on the second time. I found like I was finding a lot of stuff I missed, and knowing the expectations really improved my feelings about it.
Absolutely, me too. And I went through a lot of those treasure box portals the first time through. So I ended up like proceeding through the game, I think, in a very weird way.
Yeah.
Like it got to a point in my first playthrough whenever I saw like a castle, I would like go look for the side entrance. and usually there is one. So I would end up in castles in weird ways. Like now I'm trying to like kind of face up everything and see what that sequence is like. And that feels cool and satisfying too. But like I said, it also is going hand in hand with me being New Game Plus and having plus 10 everything in weapons. So it's just fun in general.
Yeah. It's nice to be able to have a little bit more leeway to, like, for me, it helps me, like, pay attention to different encounters when I'm not terrified of, you know,
right. dying.
Well, and I mean, not just not terrified, but you're also less likely to die. So you're like, you're more likely to see more of it. You're seeing moves you don't see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, like things that might have one shot you before, you can tank and then you can see what the follow up is. It makes a big difference.
Like, this is the only FromSoft game, like, outside of Dark Souls 2, where, you know, which had new content, kinda, in the New Game Plus. Like, I am really enjoying the New Game Plus experience on Elden Ring. Like, it's opened things up for me.
Mike, what would you want to see, you know, if they're going to do... Elden Ring was hugely successful. It printed money. They're probably going to do something else with it.
Right.
So either like a DLC or a sequel. Is there anything that you specifically want to see come forward? Is there anything you want to see them go back to? Is there anything you never want to see again? Like, how would you pitch such a thing in as much or as little detail as you like?
I let me ask you this before we go into that. Because I haven't heard you two talk much about Elden Ring, just because I haven't dug back into the podcast recently. What do you all think of the story in this game, in as much detail as you'd like to go into?
I really love Elden Ring holistically. So, like, I love the game as a whole. The story, I think, it is less direct and kind of suffers from hugeness and overlap. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of the entities from, like, a plot perspective, I think, accomplish overlapping things. Right. You know, for example, like, there are, you know, many kind of subjugated, you know, there's the demi-humans, and then there's also the, what are they called?
Misbegotten.
Misbegotten, you know, mm-hmm. and the Vulgar Militia, and you know, so there's a lot of that stuff, which makes it feel a little messy in terms of a plot.
Right.
But what works for me in terms of the story, it reminds me a little bit of our approach to Bloodborne or Dark Souls 2, where what I'm finding is, like, a lot of thematic strength. Like, it feels like if the plot of what happened is not that interesting, but the themes of you know, falsehoods of authority, or like people trying to understand things you can't understand. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of interpretation of greater forces and being manipulated without knowing it.
Yeah.
And the people manipulating you are also being manipulated.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes all the way up. I think it does a lot of really strong thematic work with that, while not having a direct plot that is that interesting, if that makes sense.
Yeah. That kind of cascading, you know, multiple levels of manipulation and deception, also relating to, you know, different identities for individual people, that really lands great for me. I think that this handles cosmic horror in a really, really good way. Possibly for me, maybe even a little bit better than Bloodborne does, although that they're pretty close. In that regard. But yeah, I have a, you know, real appreciation for the thing that Elden Ring does most differently, which is an emphasis on kind of the personalities and relationships of these powerful figures and the specific ways in which they have failed the people that you know, ultimately rely on them in this civil war. That is something that, you know, that was a bit of an undercurrent previously. For this, it's really on Front Street, and it's given me a real new appreciation and a new way of looking at these areas as we go through them.
That's so interesting. You definitely brought up something with the civil war themes and how you can see that happening in the world. Like, you happen upon certain areas and there's knights fighting Misbegotten, and I really enjoy that. And I think to go along with that, I see what you guys are, what you're saying about the themes too. And my takeaway though, from my first playthrough of the game, is that I have no idea what's going on at all. Like, I see all of this cool stuff happening all over the place. I'm hearing all of this dialogue about all of these different demigods and demi-humans, and I just have no idea what's happening. And again, and I keep harping on this, right? But Dark Souls games sequence, open world broke the sequence. So in open world, and especially the way FromSoft does an open world, there's literally story in every quadrant of the game.
Yeah.
And I think it's so much that I can't follow it at all. And then, you know, when I do try to pay attention, there's all of the, there's Godfreys and Godwins and Godrics.
Yeah, go to Freud's.
Ranala's and Ronnie's and Milena's and Mikula's and Melania's and and I just can't, like, I cannot wrap my head around it. I found that part to be, I won't call it frustrating, but I think it hurts my experience of the game a little bit, because and this could be dependent on how I've experienced the previous games, is that I've played through them, and typically I've not done a great job of getting them either, but I'd go on YouTube and hear the experts and listen to podcasts and hear experts, and then they're able to kind of put it together for me, and it really enriches my experience of the game. This time, like, it's just not working. It's there's so much happening, and the experts even are having such a hard time piecing everything together, that the story is just too unwieldy for me this time. And so in service of the question of what would I like to see in some DLC, like, I would love to see something that makes the story a little clearer.
It ties it together.
Yeah, like, just helps me to think about what's happening in this world in more of a substantial way, and more of a visceral way. Yeah. Because right now I just feel like, okay, well, I'm just going through killing everything to try to get the pieces of this thing that I barely ever use, so I can be the new lord of the thing that I don't really understand.
Yeah.
And it's fun, but I'm missing that part of the engagement, because right now the story just feels like a mess. And then once somebody told me that all of the bosses' names share the initials of George R.R. Martin, like, part of me wanted to be through. Part of me was like, how fucking dare you?
I never put that together, and I want, oh, man.
That's rough.
I'm gonna have to process that.
There's so many of them too, so it'd be like it's like writing his name across the moon. It's so maximalist.
Oh my goodness.
I think what you're talking about is kind of a common thing, both in, like, lore people who I'm seeing on YouTube, and then just also, like, people discussing in our Slack and such. And to me, what it feels like a little bit is that, like, I'm not convinced that Elden Ring has a really good story, or that it can have a good story because of that open world. Like, when we first started doing the season on it, it's the reason why I was thinking of it in terms of, like a D&D source book.
Yeah.
You know, I want to know just about the factions. I want to know about this critter and this land. Like, I want to know the Atlas and the bestiary and the who's who of this place. It's not as much about, you know, and I like that they're characters. Like, I think the character stuff actually works too. It's just the plot is all over the place.
It's diffuse. Like, it's incredible.
The plot is very diffuse.
Yeah. And I definitely I can agree with you that, you know, DLC, especially if it is its own roughly self-contained thing, if it has a chance to be a little bit more focused and still related to the themes, but just kind of, like, hit directly as opposed to hitting all over the place, I think that would satisfy a lot of needs, you know, of people who kind of had a similar reaction.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope they do that too. And they've done it before, like, in terms of tying things together. Did you, when you played Dark Souls, did you play the DLC for it?
I did go back and play the DLC for that too.
Yeah. I feel like that DLC does a really good job of tying that story together.
It's really fantastic. Yeah. What it does with the kind of time travel aspect. I was not expecting that, and I found it very enjoyable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Super cool. Well, we're just about up on time that we had for this. Is there anything, any remaining thoughts you have on this that you want to say, or anything really at all before we let you go?
I don't think anything useful, but I don't know. I enjoy listening to you all talk about these games. I think it's just so cool that there's games that exist that are deserving of this much dissection and discussion. And you know, I'm always looking forward to playing more. I was reading today that Miyazaki talked about some other game that they're about to announce soon, and I'm like, whoa, what can that be?
yeah, they just a couple of them, because a long time ago they hinted at a new Armored Core, but they have multiple. They're like staffing up.
Yeah,
that's amazing. I'm really happy not only that these games exist, I'm happy that they are successful.
Yes.
I think that ultimately means so much for challenging media in the world. Like if there's other genres of entertainment that can point to something like this and say, hey, we don't have to assume all our audience or consumers are dumb, and there's a lot of people who are really into this, I think like that expands to stuff as unrelated on the surface as rap music, even, you know. Yeah. if I can present stuff like this that exists and is popular and has these kinds of communities around it, I just think it's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I absolutely agreed. You know, I mean, obviously we're biased. We make part of our living, you know, this, like this, this game being as good as it did was life changing for us, in a really literal sense.
Yeah.
But it is awesome just as a fan, you know, even before this was our jobs, like as a fan of the medium. It's real cool when you see something esoteric and challenging and real heady get rewarded.
Yeah.
You know, in the brutal, awful marketplace of capitalism or stuff like that is usually ignored.
100%. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I've lived that. So it's good to see a success story.
Yeah. And to see that success story influence other things and have that success, you know, kind of be a halo out. Right. And, you know, just people are rewarded for kind of following along and making their own challenging work that pulls ideas from. It's real heartening.
Where can people find you, Mike?
On the internet at MikeEagle.net and on Twitter a lot on that particular narrow hallway of the internet. So at Mike_Eagle on there. And yeah, I'm always doing stuff, touring, putting out podcasts, putting out albums. So, people can check in on what I'm doing.
Absolutely. Recommend. Yeah. Thank you.
And once again, thank you so much to Open Mike Eagle. That was a very good time.
Yeah. Has a new album coming out.
He does.
So, yeah, a new single called I'll Fight You. You can check that out on his Twitter. And then kind of get news about the album coming out. So real cool. He put together a playlist of like songs that influenced the single, which is something I would love musicians to do.
Oh yeah.
That's such a cool idea. Like kind of be like, fuck you, Song Exploder. I'll explode my own song. You know? I'll tell you what it is. I like it.
That's great. Now onto the email interview. We've got some folks from New Blood, and a very cool. I feel like such a dork.
It's real hip and happening.
Yeah, real hip and happening.
It does the jitterbug.
Yeah, it does the Lindy Hop. No, they're doing amazing work in kind of like retro throwback shooter kind of stuff. They have Gloomwood coming out here soon. Previously, they had Dusk. They have Ultra Kill. Doing tons of cool stuff, and we have two of the folks from there, Dave Oshry and Dylan Rogers.
Yeah, the connections may not obviously seem there for these things, but if you look at Gloomwood, which is a game you and I are both greatly looking forward to,
champion of the bit.
Yeah, absolutely champion of the bit. There's a lot of Bloodborne DNA, and I've followed Dylan on Twitter for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like a cool voice in immersive sim fandom. Mm. And has always had really cool insights about the Soulsborne games as well.
Mm-hmm.
So let's read an interview.
Let's do. Do you want to do the questions or do you want me to let's just go back and forth?
Yeah, we'll go back and forth reading questions and answers. That seems like the most equitable way. and it won't make it feel like I'm, because we're interviewing two people.
Yes, we are.
So I'll get started here. First question that we asked for this, what is your history with FromSoft games? Dave from New Blood has only played Elden Ring, so new to the series. Dylan says, Dark Souls was my first FromSoftware game, but it wasn't until Bloodborne that their style of game clicked for me. I have since played Demon's Souls on the PS3, Dark Souls 1, 2, and 3, Bloodborne, Sekiro, and Elden Ring, and all of their respective DLCs.
So, he's run the whole course there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Bloodborne clicking makes sense. I think that happens for a lot of folks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Next question here. Where does Elden Ring land for you in the corpus of the company's work? What's specifically interesting to you about Elden Ring in this context? Dave has only played Elden Ring, so going to pass on that.
Kind of an NA. And
it does not apply. But Dylan says, honestly, I was pretty on the fence about Elden Ring initially. After Dark Souls 3, I was fairly tired of the formula. Sekiro was refreshing in a bunch of ways, and I was worried Elden Ring was going to backslide into their comfort zone too much. I became more interested in it once I heard that they were essentially experimenting with combining an open world with the more traditional Souls gameplay flow, mostly since I wasn't sure how that was going to work out and thus was intrigued at what solutions they had.
Yeah, I remember you and I, it's interesting hearing from people who have, there's a connection there where like you and I both, it was getting a little stale with Dark Souls 3. I think we both felt that.
Yep.
You know, like largely story stuff, but even just, you know, it's Dark Souls again. And then we just had a long enough break for us. Like the way that I feel like for a lot of people, Sekiro was this huge breath of fresh air for me. You know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but as like a mild fan of that game, it kind of It's a Wonderful Life to me and showed me like what I'm missing, you know, and then I was very happy to have Elden Ring become, you know, again, like everyone's like, oh man, it's just gonna be open world Dark Souls. And then my joy when I was like, oh, R1 heavy, you know, light attack, R2 heavy attack, like it's just open world Dark Souls.
Yeah.
Fuck yes. You know, huge, huge good feels for me, but it's interesting how there's kind of two sides of that divide.
Yeah, yeah, just a fear of backsliding and kind of backsliding being a little bit what I want.
Yeah, it's a little fun to backslide.
Yeah, yeah,
like on a hill.
I'm just saying, slides in the name.
Third question here: has your opinion on it changed since release? Dave had just beat it, so that, you know, the main thing wants DLC, so wants more. Dylan says yes and no. The open world element was far stronger than I was anticipating. For the first time in a long time, I felt just floored at how much the world kept expanding. I still am not entirely sure how they managed to pull some of it off. I love the parts of Elden Ring where you're just riding around and experiencing the world unravel. Also, the verticality. I loved the way they actually designed many of the areas around the notion that jumping was now a useful way to climb over walls, columns, and railings. The no part comes from the later portion of the game, which I personally feel maybe lacks some of the refinement in combat and boss design that From had shown in Sekiro.
Yeah, I can see that.
And it's also like pretty common. We're, you know, I think that we'll talk about this when we get there, but the pacing of Elden Ring does not do itself any favors by like it kind of leading you to save a series of optional super bosses for the end.
Yeah.
You know, and then having all those optional super bosses in a row and mandatory super bosses, you know, just, it does become boss fighty in a way that the game had a really pretty beautiful proportion up until that point, like taking a break to explore and then fighting a boss.
And, you know, I'd be curious to see this just like expressed as data, but, you know, sample enough people and ask like, hey, where do you think it started running out of steam? Because, you know, probably definitely maybe like halfway through Albus, probably, or Altus rather.
A lot of people, I think, go a lot further than that.
Yeah.
The most common thing I hear is like Ferrum Azula, which is late.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's because that's a really hard area as well.
Oh yeah.
But that is by far that, and then also you know, the mountaintops of the giants, like the area right before that. But most people I think get through Lindell just fine. Mm-hmm. You know, and it but that definitely does feel like an ending.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Next question here. So what do you want to see from carry forward into what's next? Do you want sequels and DLC? Dave says, yes, I want DLC. Don't know about a sequel. That's probably about where I fall to, you know? And Dylan says, for the most part, I've enjoyed their DLCs, so definitely. As for sequels, I'd probably prefer they continue to move on to new IPs, since it gives them room to play with mechanics and concepts without being restricted to past lore or references.
It's such a tricky thing, for me there, because it's like I don't want a Dark Souls 3 situation of like, yes, I remember America, you know, but I do want more of this play.
Yeah.
And maybe more than a DLC would provide. You know, it's like I want one sequel. I don't want two.
Yeah, I suppose I want to see like another angle on this, and then for them to do kind of what they've done a handful of times, which is pack up their house themes and house, styles, gimmicks and stuff, and then take them and redeploy them elsewhere in a different context.
Yeah. It's all academic since we're getting an armored core, apparently. Next question. Finally, for something light, what is your favorite area and favorite boss? What build did you use? And Dave says, I think overall, I liked Liurnia the most, including Rhea Lucaria being my favorite legacy dungeon. Volcano Manor was a close second. Rykard is my favorite boss, gimmicky as it were. I played a faith/strength build, Blasphemous Blade go brrrr, which, yeah, it do.
Yeah, indeed it do.
Yeah. And then Dylan says, favorite area, this is a tough one. In terms of exploration, I had a lot of joy jumping around the rooftops and courtyards of Stormveil Castle and Rhea Lucaria. I was smitten by just how much of the level they were willing to let me climb around on. This probably is the immersive sim player developer in me, but just jumping over a wall or onto a rooftop to skip some difficult enemies was so satisfying. But the cheeky answer I have is Caelid. I have a fondness for levels that incite a strong emotional response from players. Watching people and myself react to Caelid with funny screenshots, gameplay clips, and memes about just how horrible it was so, so funny to me as a designer. It's that Blighttown experience all over again, a zone you love to hate. It's the accepted solidarity between players that, yes, this place really sucks, and we're all in this together, that makes me really love how the interplay of multiplayer and word of mouth works in these games. My build was kind of a mix between Guts from Berserk with heavy two-handed swords and Garrett from Thief with black cloaks/cowls and a strong bow. My next character is going full mage, lol.
Hmm.
Full mage is real fun and real different.
Yeah.
So, on the off chance Dave listens to this, I keep responding to these like I'm talking to the person, even though I just said it, which is me being a Bluntstone.
So. Oh man. I really like the answer of Caelid as a favorite area just because of the developer perspective.
Yeah. It does get that kind of like the flippant way is it's like sicko mode. Mm-hmm. You know, you're appreciating something about it, but it does add that feeling of camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
That happens and it's the right touch for it. Like I have seen as many people complain about Faramazula as Caelid in terms of a level or the Hallig Tree as a level. But it's not, those are, since they're end game and they're clearly optional.
Yeah.
You know, you think Caelid is optional, but you know what I mean? Clearly optional, you don't get that same kind of like early game Blighttown thing. You know, the people complaining about Blighttown has a different flavor than people complaining about the Demon Ruins.
Yeah.
For example.
It does. Yeah. The feeling that they're getting to is like something can be lifted if like there are people there for you to look at and just kind of like exchange that. Are you seeing this shit? Look.
Yes. Yeah. Has tons of value.
Tons of value.
Huge thanks to Dylan and Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Just one of my favorite current developers. Looking forward to what they bring, what they publish. Big thanks.
Yeah.
For taking the time.
Gloomwood's going to be hitting early access here. I think it was delayed by a couple of months or so, but the demo is out and the demo is kind of its own thing. So go check that out. It's on Steam. Big thumbs up on that.
Yeah, absolutely. www.thiefwithguns, which is a funny URL.
Their URL game is on point. It really is.
Yeah, absolutely. Some news. So some news you can use real quick before we move on to your responses. the continuing scholaring of the coward Bonfireside Chat by the Chad from Software continues. Because we, the game is a moving target. So there's been a patch, 1.06. There are tons of little gameplay. Things in this, a lot of which have to do with PvP, which is not our monkey, not our circus. But we'll probably change things as we talk about them. Some things will be less effective than we thought they were, or they were during our playthrough, or more effective.
I liked your take on it on Twitter, which was, you know, don't really play PvP, so this doesn't apply to you. However, it is very funny that the patch got the phrase "rivers of blood" trending.
Yes, just on Twitter, "rivers of blood," and I was like, "This is a little on the nose." 2022. it's what it, from the writers of "Don't Look Up." Today's Twitter trending, you know, just very very obvious. I trust people who are involved in that world to say this is a good change. Apparently that was dominating PvP to a degree that was not fun. I like the choice that they are nerfing that specific weapon as opposed to bleed in general. I get the sense they still want it to be a viable PvE thing. They just want to up the variety in PvP. The biggest thing for PvE that I found that it will have an impact is that they made a lot of changes to make light builds viable. Changing the distance and speed that you roll with a light equipment load. Previously, there was really no reason to go light load in this game. Now, apparently there is. It makes dodging the waterfall foul dance for Millennia like a lot easier. It just apparently makes a pretty big difference. Really cool that they're like still paying attention to not just PvP balances, but things that could affect the entire game for all players.
It's welcome, I think. PvE change that is made there as well, that actually is apropos of this area, is that in 1.06 they changed White Mask of Ares quest. So he still gives you the finger, just, you know, up yours, buddy. He still gives you the invasion item, and you can still pass that part of it by going and invading some folks. If you do not or are unable to do PvP, then they put in an NPC called Magnus of the Beast Blood in North Central Altus by, I think it's the Weeping Village or something like that. It is a it's an invader who you can summon in. You fight him, and then that will satisfy that particular portion of the quest, which is interesting because it that pushes progressing him and joining that faction back much further.
Which is interesting. Interesting move and good. Like anything that adds more options, I'm in favor of. For this. There are a bunch of other little changes that we're not going to remark on. I don't know. So I follow a bunch of Souls YouTubers and a bunch of them previous to this, I saw a lot of Skies Falling, like the last chance for Elden Ring, because people were very upset about Bloodhound Step and Rivers of Blood in the PvP scene.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, it's annoying, man. It's a stove that sometimes it's a stove. It's hot, but sometimes it gives me food. I follow these things. I get these annoying takes, but then also sometimes there's good. What I was leading to with that, though, is that the implication in a lot of those was this was the last patch. I haven't seen anything to suggest that is necessarily true. So there could definitely be more moving target stuff.
Well, I mean, everybody knows numbers only go as high as 1.06.
It's the highest number.
24.
I would welcome, I'm glad that they are still paying attention to it. The more the barrier, as far as I'm concerned.
Agreed. Any other patch stuff?
That's the big thing.
Okay.
That I noticed. It looks like, I didn't notice this. You've got it here in the notes that you can buy upgraded smithing stones in New Game Plus.
Yes, that was a, a handful of people told us this in the responses. This is the follow-up errata stuff that I brought over from general comments. Apparently that is true. Also, a few people brought this up, but the finger reader crone, we expressed a little bit of puzzlement over her talking about something in a big pot. People said, hey, you Blundstones, literally referring to the giant pot that Albus is hiding in.
Yes. Yeah. Something about the language at the time made it feel like a pot in a poker game to me. But yeah, that makes total sense.
I was picturing a, maybe because it was an old crone saying this, I was picturing a witch's cauldron.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Crone zone. and then, Brian mentions, the converted putt tower, that you need to use the erudition gesture to get to the top. If you don't have the gesture, you can actually climb on a crumbling wall, to skip the puzzle and get up top. I think that there's another one that I knew you could do that at.
Yeah.
I did not know you could do it at this one.
That's so nice.
I love that they leave that in and they don't care.
Mm-hmm. You know? Jump button,
I have a
baby.
I have a double jump horse. You know,
just let me roll with it. Come on.
Yeah. Let's move on to your responses.
Yeah.
Listeners.
I put some shorty ones in here just because they seemed fun. Coleman writes, Liurnia is, and specifically Raya Lucaria, it's an interesting area. I think that the run from the Grace to the area. Red.
I know.
What?
The Raya Lucarias are interesting.
What are
I was just doing the Larry King Sonic.
Oh,
okay. Interesting is too common a word to get hermit crabbed by Larry King, I think. But once I started picking up on that part of the interview, I can't not hear it now. So hedgehogs okay. are interesting. It's just a weird thing to say. Larry Lucario is interesting.
Yeah, I'm Radon. Nobody cares about
me. It's about me. not worth cutting you off for, but
no, that's fine. That's fine. I think that Raya Lucaria is an interesting area. I think that the run from the Grace to the Red Wolf is my favorite place to PvP in those hallways. You bastard.
Yes.
Jeez, it's already hard enough. Unconscionable
monster.
Obviously, I'm just playing it up.
M says rudest lobsters I've ever met. They're extremely rude lobsters.
Lobsters are pretty rude.
Yeah, they're rude dudes. That's why we have to rubber band them.
Mm-hmm.
I would love if my least, you know, boy, this isn't just going to invite somebody to be really mean to me. But I was going to say my least, you know, appealing characteristic could just be rubber banded away. You know, and like, so, you know, there's, you know, I got my share of weird fucking trolls who won't leave me alone. And one of them's going to make a joke about shooting me probably because of that.
Probably,
you know, if I had to guess, but the, you know, the idea that we just take lobsters and just like nya and neutralize them entirely is very funny to me. But these ones can snipe.
Yeah.
So they got the technology.
Yeah. I mean, rudest lobster is a pretty high bar when lobsters have taken as their PR guy, Jordan Peterson. So
yeah, 100%. It's a rude lobster.
Josh says, the last shorty response here, I don't have much to add, but someone should make a Twitter like, can you pet the dog? But instead it's, does the game have a turtle pope?
Just one game gets it.
Yep.
It'd be a very funny Twitter account, like that Welcome to the Bathroom Twitter account that just has one tweet and then, you know, just stays there. You know about at bathroom tweeting, no. Welcome to the bathroom only, and that's their only tweet, right?
No.
Or maybe at toilet, but it's just like, welcome. That's like, that's the only thing they tweet. It's very funny.
Welcome to the toilet. Huh.
Well, moving on to the longer responses, and just as a heads up, we do condense these sometimes. If people say things that are covered elsewhere, we will sometimes just include one response and have it stand in for several. We also sometimes edit these, and please don't have your heart broken if we don't read them. Every once in a while, something does cover similar ground.
Yes.
So just those caveats for this type of episode. Steve says, I'll never forget the moment you first step out of the lake facing cliffs after defeating Godric, which for me was among the most mesmerizing experiences in Elden Ring. The golden Erd tree towering above, a majestic castle floating in the sky, it gave me the feeling that the preliminary part of my journey had ended. I was now ready to set off and traverse this massive landscape, somehow get close to that castle, or academy, as I would soon realize, and eventually find my way to the foot of the Erd tree. That sense of scale and seeing your objective in the distance encapsulates the feeling of adventure in Elden Ring.
there were a lot of folks who wrote in about that initial view, including, I think, more than one person who compared it to the, you know, Bethesda leaving the vault, leaving the opening cave moment, you know, how big it is. And I think just something about Liurnia in general that Steve is hitting on and a lot of people are is the shape of it, which is to say it is a gigantic landmass, but it's also incredibly long. You know, it's, you know, oblong, and you're looking at its longest axis, and it's just kind of like right up the barrel, focusing your view and showing you exactly just like, oh, everything is really, really far away. You know, probably even further than it looked at looked when I was just kind of like down in Limgrave, you know, kind of looking up at it across that big bay there, the Central Ocean.
Yes. Yeah. Agreed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
So
Andrew says, I am grateful that they didn't add any barely visible underwater trenches like in previous games. Those always felt like cheap bullshit deaths for games renowned for being tough but fair. People complain, but I'll gladly take ejaculating lobsters instead, because at least I can see them coming. Waka waka. I don't, the waka waka was me. I just thought that was very good.
Yeah. Ejaculating lobsters. Cole, if I put a gun to your head, could you answer confidently whether lobsters ejaculate?
No.
Yeah, of course. Like, it's just a very, like, what a funny thing not to know. Is there spider cum? Like, I don't know. Like, no, my book of spell reagent says yes, but like my experience says no.
You know what? Like, there is a factoid. I do know that if you put, like, if you take a female lobster and look in the little spinneret, you know, antlion maw that they have back there, swimmeret rather, you can tell if they recently mated. But I don't know if they just like take a little globule of their genetic stuff and put it there.
Jesus Christ!
Like, what, no, you can see the leaving. Yeah.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know about tamale or tamal or whatever it's called?
Yeah, it's the green stuff in the brain.
Yeah. Like, they're fucking lobsters, dude.
You know, I've never eaten a whole lobster, and I feel like we've talked about this in abject suffering or whatever, but the fact that it is this big dissection process, I'll eat a crab leg, you know, because I can abstract that away. Obviously eating chicken off the bone, but a whole ass thing that you're like, you know, like, oh, this is the stomach. There are teeth in there. We have to discard this.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to feel like I'm doing a fucking autopsy with lemon butter.
No. The closest thing is a pile of chicken wings. And the creature that all makes together shouldn't live in the first place. Like,
so, biblically accurate chicken.
Yeah.
Jesus. Jinx. Yeah.
But the, I don't, it's a mercy that you dissect that and eat it.
Yeah. Oh, man. What's Jeff say?
Jeff says, one of my favorite aspects of Elden Ring is the way the geography feels both coherent and surprising. Liurnia is one of the best areas for this. The first glimpse from the base of Stormvale reveals the general shape of the entire space, but once you start traversing it, you find new vantage points that complicate it in your mind. The huge cavern holding the village of the Albinerics is a standout example, but this experience appears in subtler ways too. I think about the journey through the northern tributary towards the mineshaft that leads to the Altus Plateau, bypassing the lift. I looked down at this area from above and hadn't seen anything that stood out to me, but when I returned to explore with those massive cliffs channeling me claustrophobically onward and found that the mineshaft leading up along the cliff face to a new continent, it dramatically shifted my understanding of the space. What's more, it wasn't a dreamy, weamy, spacey, wacy thing. It maintained, even complicated, my sense of the world's coherence. Traversing Liurnia helped me begin to grasp how stunning an achievement the Lands Between's design really is, even more than Limgrave did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well stated.
Yeah. I don't know that I have anything to add, but, you know, I think that the way that it channels movement is very canny.
Yes. Yeah. And it is, again, you know, that feeling of having spaces recontextualized is a FromSoft staple. Mm-hmm. It's the, you know, one of the pillars of Dark Souls 1, you know, magic of Firelink things in the way that world, it's kind of borrowing a little bit of that energy.
Yeah.
Like opening up a back door that goes to somewhere you've been recontextualizes a space. Seeing one of these landscapes from a different angle, and knowing what's on the other side of one of these land features recontextualizes on kind of a like a topographic scale,
mm-hmm.
which is neat. You know, also cool. Yeah.
Drew writes, stumbling into Liurnia before ever approaching Stormvale gave me major stumbling into Blighttown through the Valley of the Drakes vibes, which were only solidified when I stumbled up towards the Coward's Path into Altus Peninsula or Altus Plateau before ever reaching Raya Lucaria. FromSoft's dense labyrinthine approach to level design has this magical ability to make me feel like I'm doing a big brain sequence break, when actually I'm just being a big stubborn moron who refuses to go where I'm supposed to and probably couldn't figure out where that is, even if I wanted to.
That's a, like a really canny observation that comes up a lot. You know, just speaking of Dylan and New Blood, comes up a lot in immersive sims, where mm-hmm. like a lot of the appeal is I can get here however I like, and it feels clever getting there, even though all of that stuff is meticulously designed to allow it. It's not like I stumbled upon a vent the developers didn't want me to find. I stumbled upon, I did, it played exactly into their hands. They gave me a vent.
Yeah.
You know? Same thing here.
It's I mean, to take it even further, it's kind of a Stanley Parable thing. You know, even if you think you're getting out of the box, you know, the developer designed the space outside the box too. It's just a bigger box.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all boxes all the way down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Josh says, Liurnia felt pretty empty and samey to me. There were some really cool outcroppings of buildings, sunken towns and the like, but it's definitely the place I got turned around the most, other than maybe Caelid, but that place fucked me up for more than just that reason. again, going back to that response from earlier.
I feel like this is true in the center of the region. I think once you get up onto the cliffs on the outside, I think that is where most of the incident is. But I can see feeling this way about kind of the bog in the center.
And the thing about the bog that I relate to, like I love Liurnia, but is that feeling that I'm missing things in that big empty space. You know, I almost had to do like a kid's search. You know, like coordinate off put into down a grid. Yeah, put down a grid. See if I could review babysitting like Forrest McNeil. And just and see, you know, just to make sure I saw everything.
Yeah.
You know, which is also, I mean, just that open world, that Bethesda connection that somebody wrote in before, that's also the glowing sea in Fallout 4 for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I want to see all the stuff that's here, and it's a big zone.
Yeah. So. Brian writes, Liurnia is the part of the game where the novelty of torrent and mounted combat started to wane for me. The fact that you can't dodge or get any iframes or do much of anything special on horseback really started to bug me while fighting the giant crabs, lobster snipers, and big old groups of albinorics and monks that you end up running into. The way all these enemies hit stun torrent leaves you open to being stun-locked and knocked off with no real recourse other than to run away. That combined with Liurnia being one of the largest regions in the game really started to give me torrent fatigue. It's not that I don't believe he's a very good boy. Of course he is. And I genuinely love his design. But there's just not that much there other than the double jump to differentiate him from just a much faster stripped down version of the player character.
Yeah, I disagree with this. And the reason why is that, I used mounted combat almost exclusively for like dragons and shit.
Yeah.
And that felt like a different game to me. Yeah. Like when you're managing a much bigger space and using torrent to manage those distances, I did feel like the new verb that was added wasn't dodge. It was create an immense amount of space quickly.
Mm-hmm.
There, if I had tried fighting mobs, or lobsters, like which are basically kind of mini bosses with torrent, I might've felt the same way.
Yeah.
But typically he was for big guys for me.
This gets down to what does the game do to communicate to you when you should be using torrent for a fight?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how effective is that? Because it kind of seems like there is something missing there.
Well, how it communicates it to you and in ways other than just efficaciousness.
Yes.
You know, like for me, and this is subjective, but for me, the fact that when I tried fighting with torrent against the mob and I would get knocked off my horse, it didn't work. That communicated it to me. I was mm-hmm. like, okay, this is not right. But the fact that I was much more effective against like dragons and shit like that, Like I was just encouraged by results rather than like signaling, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is this me or you?
This is you.
Matthew says, Liurnia offers the first glimpses we get of some of the game's most fucked up little dudes. I definitely see references to other works in the dude design. The Albinarics are clearly a nod to the milky-blooded androids of the Alien films. While we're on sci-fi, the shape-shifting Silver Tears sure seem to be inspired by the T-1000 from Terminator 2. Speaking of robots, who else thinks that the warrior jars, particularly Alexander, are an homage to TikTok from Return to Oz? As it happens, Liurnia has a whole Return to Oz vibe. Once beautiful continent, with its Emerald Kingdom now crumbling, sinking, and becoming overrun by stone-faced kings and torture devices.
Yeah, Fariza Balk does voice Renala.
Yeah, well, and the little robot guys.
Yeah,
little wind-up guys.
Yeah.
They're like wheelers from Return to Oz. There wasn't really a good place to put this. The second jet Albinarics look almost exactly like a specific magic card.
Hmm.
Like a creature that is in a magic card.
Huh.
I'm not saying that they're not the alien, you know, the milky blooded androids from the Alien films, or there was no inspiration there. I'm just saying that like there's a bunch of magic cards that are directly Elden Ring things.
Yeah. Yeah. Just because this is a response that kind of relates to this a little bit, but somebody else wrote in saying that they saw in the first generation Albinarics the replicants from Blade Runner, specifically the obsolescence that's built into them. Mm. So there is that Ridley Scott kind of deal.
Yeah, interesting. Like cool things. And who, you know, it's a melange, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't even know necessarily when From creates one of these things. Sometimes it's very obvious that they're like, yes, this is that, you know, this is specifically this, but they also are people and creators who digest a diverse array of media.
Mm-hmm.
All of these answers can be correct.
Yeah.
It could all be a melange that got put together in their head.
Convergent evolution.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why crabs are in all these games.
Yeah. Cause he saw a crab once. He's like, man, that's fucking fucked up. You know, what's weird is they've never done a horseshoe crab. And those things are like, they're harmless. Mm-hmm. No, they're good. They're good creatures.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Are those things scary?
Yeah. I don't care for those one bit.
It's like a shield. It's like something in a crawling shield.
It doesn't look like a living creature. Yeah. I've always thought those things were a little bit fucked up. My first exposure was Milhouse without his glasses petting one and it making that little sound.
I love it so much. When I went to Cape Cod, littered with dead horseshoe crabs.
Fun.
Yeah, just really bleak. Like it was it was the Ringed City for them.
It's like the last vacation I took in 2016 out to the Virginia Island where my family goes to. It's like, oh, we're going to take a boat out to the sandbar. Okay, cool. Sandbar. Neat. Mm-hmm. And it's just this little slice of sand that's out there. It's from afar, it's sand. When you're close up, it's nothing but seagull skeletons and crab shells.
It's so funny how grisly the ocean is.
Yeah.
Like you go out to the beautiful Oregon coast and it's like the most beautiful thing in the world. And you have to look out to step on dead jellyfish, like landmines.
Uh-huh.
So you don't do a Three Stooges slip just on the corpse of a beautiful nonsensical creature.
Amazing. Moving on here, Matt writes in saying, Liurnia is the place where I made my favorite personal lore discovery. Well, at first I thought that the cuckoo was just a cool bird that they used to represent the local night enemy type. Something stuck in my brain and wouldn't let go. Over time, the game revealed the history. While the Academy was neutral in the Shattering, it wasn't neutral in the Divorce. They stayed loyal to Radagon. Cuckoos are brood parasites. They lay their eggs in other birds' nests and are the root of the internet's favorite insult, cuck. Radagon cheated on his wife and left her to care for his weird egg. Then it all came together for me. Radagon is the goddamn cuckoo. Those are his goddamn knights. I'm a goddamn genius. I know the timeline in Elden Ring is weird and this is tenuous, but this will be canon to me until the day I die. And the joy I felt putting the pieces together in that moment was such a special experience that I had to share it.
Oh, Yeah, I don't know whether that tracks with my understanding of the, you know, timeline, you know, like, mm-hmm. like Matt says, but it's, you know, I never want to take a headcanon.
No,
you know, from somebody, it's a cool idea. And I would not be surprised if there is some like theminess,
you know,
around it, even if it's not direct.
It feels like there's something there, or, you know, enough there that it's not entirely accidental that she's holding a weird egg that Radigan left with her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, stuck him with the idea of Radagon cheating on mm-hmm. Renala, I don't think is supported in the text. And it'd be very funny if it did, because like we're getting more and more messy and uh-huh. human with our gods and everything. And we already have stepkids, but yeah. if we got to like affairs and stuff, like that'd be really something.
And also, I mean, given certain revelations about Radagon, it's it'd be a question weird. Of, yeah, what's the, yeah,
just the logistics.
Yeah.
You know, so. How's that work, man?
Oh my God.
Forrest says, "Hey guys, I wanted to comment on the giant inflated ants that live in the Ainsel River. I also read them as queen/parents when I first encountered them, but I think they're actually meant to be a reference to honeypot ants. These ants have specialized workers called repletes, which they use as living food storage. Other workers feed the repletes until they swell up, just like in the game, and then harvest the stored food later. Based on the fact that we get large runes from killing these, my guess is that a similar process is going on here, though these giant ants are likely being fed humans and the like. The body horror of a creature existing solely as a larder is really creative here." That's great.
Thank you very much for that insight, because I see an ant with a big old distended back, and I think queen, this is much more disturbing.
Yeah, I don't know which one is true. Uh-huh. But it's cool, you know.
Yeah, and you know they're not the ants aren't you know attacking you because hey you killed their brood mother or whatever. They're attacking you because you walked up to the buffet table at the Golden Corral and tipped it over.
The Google image search for honeypot ants is both fascinating and also there's an image of a woman taking a bite out of one like a grape.
Oh no.
The big distended honey dumper that it's got, and it's not cool.
We're not saying honey dumper anymore.
Huh? You're not saying honey dumper anymore. I say it all the time.
Okay.
It's after 10 p.m. We can say whatever the hell we want. Oh. I'm over here saying honey dumper. Cum shot.
You're getting mad.
I don't understand. But yeah, it's gross and cool. Really mm-hmm. cool catch.
Yeah, very good catch. Thank you, Forrest. Ethan writes, "The Academy of Raya Lucaria is easily my favorite dungeon in Elden Ring, and perhaps my favorite From Software level ever. As someone who is a sucker for all things magic, I had been anticipating the moment of waltzing into the Academy ever since I heard mention of it, and had seen its spires towering over the misty waters. The gradual buildup towards that moment is perfection. It's a long haul of moving through the swamps, piecing the story of the Academy together by examining the environment and reading item descriptions, which is all punctuated by the Academy beginning to dominate the horizon more and more. Few landmarks in Elden Ring make me feel like my destination is closing in on me rather than the other way around. When you walk through the doors, the first impression is, for lack of a better word, magical, with the wispy tendrils and vapors of starlight making it feel like I was walking through a nebula, which fits so well with the Academy's study with an obsession with stars. Study of an obsession with stars. It felt like both a byproduct of the mage's study and decorations to make the school seem more mystical. I've never played a game with such a well-realized space that captures the traditional expectations one has for a magic academy. Every other example I can think of pales in comparison to the sense of wonder Raya Lucaria exudes. The feeling hangs in the air itself."
It's a really one thing I like about Raya Lucaria as a magic academy, mm-hmm. Because I'm not, you know, even prior to, you know, just putting aside all of the shit about the author, like the idea of a magic school, like a Harry Potter magic school, is not inherently appealing to me. Like I mm-hmm. liked those movies. I liked those books at the time. But
it's still a fantasy. It's still a fictional high school.
Well, and there's a tone to it that is like ultimate whimsy, One of the things I like about Rayo Lucaria is it's like, no, this would actually could actually be dark and strict and awful. Mm-hmm. You know, like them taking this thing that is only portrayed in musical or in media as like super fun zone, largely because of, you know, Harry Potter. But like that is, but even before that, like Witch and stuff like that, Magic Academy is fun.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But this game presupposes, what if it wasn't? And I really like that. Like,
yeah,
it's a cool subversion.
If something's going to be high enough fantasy to have a magic school in it, there's a certain implied, you know, I think lack of adversity to it, or, you know, mm-hmm. that only exists in spaces of conflict, right? Oh, we've mastered magic and therefore we are enlightened enough to be above these horrible things that people do. The closest thing I can think of is like the way that sorceress schools and everything are put together or depicted in The Witcher. Mm-hmm, you know, the horrifying way that they call the sorceresses who don't who don't meet the expectations by turning them into weird slug things in their magic pool and stuff. That's fucked up.
Yeah, I am really in the pocket for any kind of non-utopian magic.
Yeah.
Like I want magic to be alien and scary and absolutely come with a huge cost.
Yeah. Well, that's why I like the Red Wizards in Forgotten Realms, you know, Fae as the bastard magic area, you know, like just give me some magic bastards, please.
Yeah. The magic bastards are great. Also like a Warren Ellis comic that never got written. I bet. I'm sure there's a crumbled up piece of paper in his waistband as a pitch for magic bastards. KL writes, getting got by the giant orb in Rayo Lucaria is one of my top Elden Ring moments. I saw the ramp and the bloodstains and knew exactly what would happen. Foreknowledge didn't stop me from trying and failing to Scooby-Doo my way out of danger, and it remains one of my favorite gags in the game.
Yeah. Good. No notes. It is very funny. Just the confidence with which I, the confidence, like, okay, it's going toward that one side. I can get around it. Oh no, it's bouncing. No. I'm down. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good comedy. Frogger, the television show comedy.
Yeah. Very similar.
Dealer Umbra writes, given what happens during Rennala's fight, what do we think she was trying to accomplish? My money is on her trying to find a way to bring Ronnie back into a physical body.
So this is interesting. I read this when it was on the Patreon, mm-hmm. like just got the notification and stuff and was thinking about it. It's a super cool idea. And I don't know for sure. It didn't fall with the impression that I got from Rennala, mm-hmm. but that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Yeah.
Rennala struck me as really profoundly broken, yes. Which we talked about in the episode, but not everybody feels that way. Kind of going through the motions, almost hollow.
Yeah.
But hollowed from divorce as opposed to hollowed from the dark sign, you know, like mm-hmm. her just continuously bringing back the Sweetings over and over and over and kind of taking care of them felt really like flowers in the attic. To me, you know, like very, like that is the impression I got. Not something that had a lot of agency or desire to make an impact on the world at this point.
Yeah, that's I agree with you. You calling it the worst case of empty nest a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah.
Really clicked for me. She strikes me as being incredibly lonely. And you know, not necessarily, you know, feeling needed, you know, just I'm reading into this obviously, but she's been abandoned by everybody by everybody except Ronnie. Right.
Yeah.
Who at least is, you know, who at least is invested enough to try and protect her. Right. Or protect her reputation anyway. Yeah. You know, which is not to, you know, take away Dealer Umbra's theory. It's just I see it more as she has a way to infinitely create things that need her. You know, what passes for company for her in her diminished state.
To me, it is a strength that both of these things that we don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and this is open to interpretation. And after we, you know, we talked about that, you know, a couple of people like reached out and did not get the same read on Randy mm-hmm. that we did, you know, okay. And that's fine. Or Rennala rather. And that's fine.
Yeah. People disagree with us about Ronnie's intentions too, but
yeah. And that's also okay. Like it doesn't bug me, you know?
Nope.
So it's interesting what will pull the pathos strings. in a From game for you. I remember when we did the episode of Bloodborne on Meikle Ash and talked about that story being a real tragedy. And a lot of people were just like, no, this guy's a fucking asshole. Like, you know, he's a monster. There's
both can be,
you
know, true.
But also they didn't get the same impression because
right.
Yeah. I'm not saying that they were correcting. I'm saying that they just didn't get that feeling from it. Mm-hmm. Whereas that feeling, you know, me, you, and Scott and David, like, all had like a real sense of pathos.
Yeah.
To that fight. So it's going to, it's going to vary.
It is.
You know? Yeah. Luna says, I fought Renala probably more times than any boss in Elden Ring, though probably not for reasons you might expect. I believe I beat her on my second attempt, but just as I did, I simultaneously died. Nevertheless, the trophy Renala of the Full Moon popped up, and when back in the library, Renala was there waiting to let me respec. Only I didn't get the runes from defeating her. They're trapped in the moon realm from her second phase, and nothing I did to return there let me get them back, including being summoned by other players. Because I'm stubborn, I put down my summon sign and helped others defeat her for as long as it took to get back the runes I felt that she owed me, and then some. It helps that she's just a fantastic boss.
I admire that stubbornness.
It, depending on where you die in the moon realm, it will spawn your runes.
Okay.
Somewhere. I've had them spawn in the first phase, but I think the moon realm is bigger than that library.
Oh,
so maybe something weird happens if you're outside the bounds of the library.
Mm.
I don't know. When you get into realms, it gets real complicated, you know?
Realms are in play. I repeat, realms are in play.
Yeah. I don't have mastery of realms, and no one does. But I've seen the runes appear before, but I certainly believe ways that they might not.
Realms are not for us to master.
Yes. Yeah. They're to master us.
Let's see. I admire that stubbornness because it resulted in you helping a bunch of people. So,
yeah.
Mr. Reciprocity writes, as I'm sure you're aware, there are a number of lower body armor pieces in Elden Ring that consist of some raggedy fabric, a few scraps of decaying metal, and no shoes. I was wearing one such piece the first time I reached the end of the Academy of Raya Lucaria. This meant that as I entered the boss arena, I was greeted by a blissed out co-ed apparently licking my character's feet, then looking up to make conspicuous eye contact while grinning like a pervert. It was a strange first impression for the Queen of the Full Moon to make, but I must say, it stuck with me.
Yeah, it does look like some foot shit. I would have noticed something like this if I ever noticed what my character was really wearing in these games. That's other than like huge things. Like, one of the biggest disconnects between I think both of us really and a lot of Souls fandom is not being as invested in the fashion, you know. I was looking at other stuff.
It's I like, literally my character's model might as well be the wireframe Little Mac from the arcade Punch-Out.
There's just something I don't see in my avatar, and there are identity things wrapped up in that. You know, I understand like that is not intentionally, but is accidentally an extremely like cis dude opinion to just be like, yeah, I don't pay attention to my avatar. It just, that's the body I am. Like, that's my experience. I can't lie about it, but
yeah,
I understand there's a privilege to that, but it is true about my experience.
Yeah. But that's a cool story. About an accidental first impression.
Yeah, it's just a tiny little baby licking a foot. Cinderelf says, I want to share my somewhat differing opinion on Renala's hat. I really like how silly it looks, and the stat boost would work great with my build. But after playing with it for a bit, I just had to take it off. It was just too large. It took up too much of my screen and distracted me from everything that was going on behind it. I think it's the first time the design of an outfit has stopped me from using something in a FromSoft game. Somebody hasn't ever tried to do Xanthus King Jeremiah's head wrap.
That's the thing.
Any of those games.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up because I was like, you know, I don't think that I've ever run into that either. And no, any of them, the Demon Souls one, that's like the big tornado or the big head wrap kind of thing, like all of those, it ultimately ends up being a visibility problem. It's like people who have big fuzzy dice hanging from their car rear view window. It's like, all right, so you're just looking through those things.
Yeah, just not interested in seeing.
Yeah.
Don't need to see into driving, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do like just trying to, you know, just you're playing and then just leaning to see if you can look around the banana.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. The, yeah. So that I was an old hand at having something in my way, you know, and the more open areas help with that. Like with the, Xanthus King Jeremiah hat, mm-hmm. that gets real bad if like, say you're in the depths.
Yeah.
You know, like you're walking around a series of hallways. There are mm-hmm. not as many hallways in Elden Ring. Like there are definitely some, but they're not as many. Yeah. So it did not get in my way, but I definitely see what Cinderolf's talking about.
Yes. And then Isa writes, Isa also provided a pronunciation guide saying like, hey, I don't know if this is welcome or not. Pronunciation guides are always welcome. Actually.
Extremely welcome.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, just, it helps keep us from looking / feeling like fools.
and accidentally hurting your feelings or offending you if you are sensitive about your name
yep.
being, you know, mispronounced.
Yeah. But Isa writes, Liurnia sounds like the best place to say this since it involves Renala. I am so thankful for the amount of times you can respec per playthrough in Elden Ring. I've scuffed an entire save of Dark Souls 3 experimenting with builds, only to find I hit a limit on a build that I didn't enjoy myself enough to bash myself against the DLC with. I know the limit is the amount of larval tears you can find per playthrough, but From was generous with their availability. I could mess with builds to my heart's content, without the fear of burning a precious resource. It may be a mechanically imperfect reflection of the rebirthing process per the lore, but I'll take better quality of life over flavor almost every time.
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit. The idea that respecs are limited, but so generous is a really nice mm-hmm. sweet spot.
Yeah.
For them, unlimited respecs can add a feeling, even if it is effectively unlimited, but a feeling of frivolence.
Yeah.
Frivolity. Frivolence mm-hmm. isn't a word. Frivolity to your decisions. Just having a limit and having to use a resource, I think, does a lot, even if it is just psychologically.
Yeah.
To that. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you like this feature, if you like the way respecs work in this game, thank your local Dark Souls 2.
Yes. Like 100%. Which you should be doing anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so many features in Dark Souls 2 not carried forward, and they're very good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm kind of hoping, I don't want it to be the main DLC, but something that people have talked about is like doing Sekiro-esque like remembrances.
Oh, yeah.
You know, kind of fights in the arena so you can refight bosses. And I'm just like, man, nobody understands or remembers Bonfire Ascetix.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that was such a cool innovation. And like, I'm really glad that, you know, that might come back.
Agreed.
So, yeah. Those are all the responses we're going to read for this roundtable episode, mm-hmm. the roundtable. Next episode, where are we going, Cole?
Next episode, we are heading north of the Academy. We are headed to the Caria Manor to start a pretty long quest chain. We're going to do Caria Manor and the Three Sisters, finally meeting Ronnie, who ends up being the quest giver for the mid game.
The degree to which I love Caria Manor is hard to overstate.
Mm-hmm.
It was just what a feeling,
mm-hmm.
you know, what a thrill. just walking through that courtyard and that first big surprise, big fucking dopey grin on my face. Looking forward to talking about those guys.
Mm-hmm. And then we're going to follow Ronnie's quest line for a little while. That's going to naturally take us underground, obviously, to Shifra, but also into Caelid, to follow that sequencing there.
We're going to follow the leveling a little bit, so we're not going to do the ending of mm-hmm. Ronnie's quest line before we do like Caelid. It doesn't make mm-hmm. any sense to do like the Lake of Rot and to go and do the stuff on that continent.
Yeah.
You know, the bosses there are hard. Like, we mm-hmm. don't need to fight Black Knife Teesh before we fight Radahn. That's silly. Yeah,
not the best way to do it. So
yeah, we're gonna do that for a little while and then get into Caelid, which I'm really looking forward to.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of bosses that like I had initial angry impression at, Radahn has probably grown the most
for yeah. me.
I really like that boss fight now. I had a really bad experience and was holding a grudge, and now I've turned around on it. I think it's really good.
It's always nice to see somebody drop a beef. Wait, that came out wrong.
It's always nice to maybe see is the wrong word there. it's a yeah. So I'm just really excited to talk about that zone and talk about Radahn, get into all of that shit. Mm-hmm. So good stuff. Thanks everybody for listening. We really appreciate you. Thank you for patronizing. Listen to the other shows. You have access to a bunch of other shows that we do. Some of them are going to be us, horsing off and dicking around, and you're not going to like that so much. But assuming that you like our, perspectives on video games and stuff like that, there's a bunch of Watch Out for Fireballs that I think you would like.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And other media stuff too. Like, listen to Unfilmable. Unfilmable rocks.
Yeah, you have access to all of it. There are like, I don't know, 40 or something of those now.
It's a good show. It is like consistently one of the better shows we do, I think.
Yeah.
So it is worth your time. Mm-hmm. Have we talked about best quality vacuum on here yet?
It might have been an offhanded mention. It bears saying. Yes. Our other show, speaking of other shows, we have done a series about the Venture Brothers. That show is called Orb on our network here. That is coming to a close because we ran out of Venture Brothers to talk about. For us, our next show to kind of replace that is going to be a show called Best Quality Vacuum, which is going to be about Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. With Better Call Saul
and El Camino.
And El Camino. I'm over here too. Don't forget me, guys.
Don't forget me. I'm El Camino.
With Better Call Saul wrapping up, now is a great time to hop into an incredibly saturated market. But both Gary and I love that universe, love those shows, and have been looking for a way to talk about it for a while. That makes sense.
Fucking chomping at the bit. It has taken all of my strength not to restart my rewatch while waiting for the finale of Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
Which if people listening to this have not been watching Better Call Saul, it's fucking incredible.
Yeah.
The last several episodes have been like this weird string of A+ basically since the season came back.
Yeah.
Have just been, some of the most arresting television I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Very exciting. If we want to infer that El Camino is small in the grand scheme of this, we should start calling it El Camino. As like the baby. So thanks everybody for listening. Check out other stuff, and we will be back next week going north.
Let's get handsy up in Caria.
And we all pray that we will have far more soon.